Yes, welcome to my talk, We Only Have One Earth, which is or was a slogan of the general natural movement. I do not claim to have invented any of the ideas within this talk myself. This is essentially an excerpt from the internet. So there will be a lot of source links and a lengthy list of sources in the end. Also, I have given a now outdated version of this same talk at the Open Mind Conference in August. So if somebody of you finds that the English is too hard to understand, then maybe you can watch the German version on YouTube. Anyway, let's get started. So you certainly know this image or a similar one from the internet or TV or you don't know it from radio. Anyway, you see a planet, and it's probably a planet you're quite familiar with because it's where we live. Unfortunately, it's also only where we live. So there's a lot of black space in this image. And in all this black space, which extends in all directions here, there are pretty much zero humans. Well, we could be happy with that, but there are many problems we face. Problem on planetary scales. Namely, we would presumably like to continue living on this planet for serious amounts of time. And we're not quite sure how much modification the planet or the subsystems making up the ecosphere of the planet can actually take. So some scientists, mainly from Sweden, tried to find, say, safe limits, how much we can push all these systems. How did they do that? They did not try to find exact points where they are sure the systems will crash, but they say, okay, we have some understanding of some of these subsystems, and we know that our current understanding will probably break down at some limit conditions, where we assume that non-linearity will start to appear. And as long as we stay within those limits we actually understand, we can predict that the systems will behave more or less stably. And outside of these limits, well, everything could possibly happen. It might be no problem at all, but we don't know that. And since we only got one try, we better take the safe route here. Obviously, this is not very exact science, because to do real science, you have to do experiments. But given only a single planet, there's a bit of shortage of materials for trying all the various paths and seeing which planets survive and which don't. So they decided to, okay, just do this theoretically. So obviously this is not experimentally validated in any way. So what are the main current problems the planetary ecosystems or planetary systems face? One is probably quite well known from public media, which is stratospheric ozone depletion. Because the stratospheric ozone prevents ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface. And if the ozone is gone, then we get more hard ultraviolet radiation, which causes skin cancer in humans and all other bad things also for animals and plants. And actually, this is quite a success story for humanity so far, because they calculated that a safe limit would be 95% of the pre-industrial amount of stratospheric ozone. And the current level is actually quite variable, as can be observed over Australia every summer, more or less. But they are quite sure that the old state will be reached around 2070 again. Similar problems exist for freshwater usage. The safe limit would be 4,000 kilometer cubes per year. Humanity overall is using approximately 2,600 of them, so there's still some wiggle room for us. Similarly for land use, the main problem is that as more land is converted to agricultural use, it has different absorption and reflection properties, and also different effects on other chemical cycles, as for example nitrogen or phosphorus. Then there's a quite large problem nobody, or most people have never heard about, which is ocean acidification. So what is the problem here? The increasing carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere generates or causes a change in acidification levels, or whatever, of the ocean, which means that more calcium carbonate can be solved in the water, which would not necessarily be a problem, but for all the small plankton which actually build their shells out of this calcium carbonate. And as the pH levels change, it gets more energy intensive to actually build these shells. And presumably they build these shells not because they love the geometry, but because they need them for protection from predators. Meaning that once the pH value gets too different from the default level they evolved to survive in, there are probably going to be large changes in plankton levels, which will cause some change. We don't know exactly which ones, but fast changes usually are too good for large predators like humans. Then there are two things they aren't quite sure about, like aerosol concentrations, which cause global cooling a little bit, and also a lot of health problems in humans and presumably other animals, and general chemical pollution. So humanity is producing a lot of so far unseen chemical things, which also do stuff. We don't know exactly what they do, because there are so many of them, so it's very hard to actually quantify the danger levels here. Yeah, then there is climate change. Everybody knows about climate change. We should have around 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We have more already, and production doesn't seem to slow down already anyway. Then there are nitrogen and phosphorus cycles, mainly influenced by agriculture. The problem is that by actually doing intensive agriculture, we need to put more nitrogen in the soil. And all this additional nitrogen is, in the end, ending up in rivers and the ocean. And yeah, changing the acidification and also doing other stuff. And then there's biodiversity loss. People think that it would be safe if we had 10 times the natural extinction rate of species. We're currently around twice to 24-bed level, depending on which interval you're actually looking at. Mm-hmm. Also, we have some limits in raw materials. We are very used to burn oil or coal or whatever. This is actually an image from the German Wikipedia. Anyway, the bar chart shows oil reserves discovered in the past, and the black dots show oil production. And obviously, there is some difference for some years already. So at some point in the future, there won't be that much oil available. People are very non-agreeing on when exactly that will be. Some people say, okay, peak oil will be here in 10 years. Some people claim peak oil has already occurred. Some international oil producing association actually says it will be within the next 50 years. So it doesn't really matter if it is now or 50 years or even 200 years. If you're talking about continued survival of humanity, we need to get away from that resource usage, obviously, and quite fast, actually. Similar problems exist for other raw materials, like coal. Coal is quite limited. We have approximately 300 years for lignite and 120 years for bituminous coal at current consumption levels. Then there are metals, which are also quite important raw materials. Fortunately, the planet core consists of a lot of metals. Unfortunately, it gets a little bit harder to mine them once it gets too hot, so price levels actually increase. I tried to compare it to something not too inflationary, so I compared it to rice prices. And if you do that comparison, you actually see a price increase by a factor of, depending on the metal, 2 to 5 over 30 years. And I fully expect that to continue. Yes, so this is like soft limits in a way. This is disaster scenarios which will take years to evolve. And then there are faster and slightly more violent ways to end humanity, like nuclear war. Everybody knows about that danger, I think. And while doing their research for the talk, well, research as in I read a lot of Wikipedia. yes, problem is there's actually quite a long list of critical situations which evolved during and after the Cold War. For example, there were some stuff happening, it doesn't really matter what exactly it was, and according to NATO plans, such incidents would have been answered by nuclear strikes, and then it continues like however, and then something went wrong with the actual execution of the plan. We will see a little bit about that. A few years later, they found out that actually there were no technical blockades to stop all the ICBMs by a single engineer, so one rogue engineer could single-handedly have started nuclear war. And then in 1979, very intelligent people watched the training tape essentially, which showed incoming missiles, and some superior apparently watched over their shoulder or whatever and thought that, oh shit, we're currently being attacked, informed the president and so on. And only a few minutes later they actually figured out that they were watching a training tape and stopped preparations for counterstrike. Yes, similarly, the other way around, in 1983, the Soviet Union believed that they were being attacked by the United States. If I remember correctly, it was due to sensor errors. And some of these incidents actually were only diffused because various, actually, single soldiers refused to obey orders. So there were very clear orders, like, if these and those things happen, then we start the counterstrike, press this button. As the very exactly specified stuff happened, they refused. Presumably not starting a nuclear war, which would otherwise have happened. In my opinion, this is not a very sustainable way of keeping humanity alive, depending on single people not following orders. In my opinion, it would be a quite conservative estimate, unfortunately, if we say, okay, over the last 50 years, round about, say, since the end of the Second World War, there was a 2% probability of actually nuclear war starting. It would not necessarily mean total extinction of humanity, but it would quite certainly mean end of current civilizations as we know it. If we just project this rate into the future for a few years, say 1,000, we find that the survival chance is actually not quite that good, like 66%, which is a lot lower than I would like them to be, and it gets obviously a lot worse once you go to 2,000 or 3,000 years. And then there are other bad things which could happen, like a global pandemic, which can now, thanks to international air traffic, spread a lot faster, meaning we would have a lot shorter time frame to enact countermeasures, like quarantine or even necessary research into vaccines. And also we get new exciting pathogens by genetic engineering, which is certainly being done in bioweapons research laboratories, and also maybe in some kitchen sinks or cellars, which that's most likely not even the dangerous kind. And then there are more exotic, but more nerdy ways to gain humanity, like strong AI, singularity or whatever, because hyper-intelligent software may not necessarily decide to support the continued existence of mankind. It would be extremely difficult to stop to cite this very nice understatement, in my opinion. One can argue endlessly about the actual probabilities of these things happening, but they do exist. This is the main problematic point, in my opinion. Okay, so what do we do? Option one is this one. I tried to find a nice image of trees and elves and stuff like that, but I wasn't able to find one which is actually under free license, so I took a screenshot of one of my favorite computer games. Anyway, the common name of this option, I'd say, is tree hugging. So we do all green stuff. Like, we are 100% renewable energies. We will use 100% renewable or recycled raw materials, which sounds nice on the surface, but it's actually quite hard to do that in construction, think concrete, and fertilizer, because you need to get that phosphorus for the fertilizer from somewhere, and so far as I know, that's pretty much only in mineral sources, and they are going to be depleted in a few hundred years as well. Then you would need to have global nuclear disarmament, and if you also want to stop this more exotic risk like Grey Goo or Strong AI or whatever have you, you would also need to have a research stop for these dangerous technologies, because otherwise, at some point in time, somebody will make a breakthrough there. This is very hard, because you need to get all these points right. If you just overlook a single of these risks, it could still kill humanity. I mean, we don't need a pandemic, anti-nuclear war, and strong AI at once. We just need one of them to go from. Or, well, me, as in we would rather not like to have them. But even assuming we succeed on all these points, we have other problems, because Mother Nature is not actually interested in keeping humanity alive. I mean, there are all kinds of random encounters in space. For example, meteorites. They don't happen that often, but they do happen. And from one kilometer diameter upwards, they're actually, well, dangerous to civilization. It heavily depends on impact location. So it could either essentially smash Antarctica into small ice sheds, nobody really cares about the penguins, could also smash North America to small silicon chips, which would obviously have a larger impact on global economy. And then there is volcanism, which happens a lot more often. So there is this very nice volcanic explosivity index, which basically just assigns random numbers to volcanic explosions. Larger number means more stuff exploded. This is basically how I feel they made up the numbers. So it starts at zero, and zero is, okay, there is some mountain and some lavas coming up out of it, and then it scales by a material amount. Anyway, approximately every 50,000 years, one of these index 8 incidents happen, which means there's more than 100 cubic kilometers of material ejected. This usually leads to global cooling because of all the dust in the upper atmosphere layers. And actually, a smaller incident happened in 1816, which what you will find under this year without a summer source down there. That was the last time that the back then civilized world actually had problems producing sufficient food. The crop failures extended across North America and Western Europe at the same time. And these were large trade centers back then, so this was actually perceived as a worldwide food shortage. Large incidents could most likely lead to stronger of these effects. And they are usually global, so it's not like a volcano explodes in South America and South America is being affected, but a volcano explodes anywhere and the world is affected. And there is another very sad observation, namely we do not know about any civilizations apart from our one so far, even though we looked into space and we tried to find some. So either the start of intelligent or let's just say building civilizations kind of life is very unlikely, or this kind of life is unlikely to spread into space. And if we wish to spread humanity into space, then we better make sure we understand why that is. So it could either be the case that we are already lucky because we had started some intelligent life on this planet and we are here, or there is still a reason in our future which so far killed all the other intelligent species we are not seeing. And this is a totally open question yet, but it is cause for some concern in my opinion, because it could well be that there are reasons in the future. So what do we do? Challenge accepted. So maybe we can fix all these problems, but how? I'm a computer scientist, as in do random stuff with digital things, but computers break, and the usual strategy is you try to decorrelate the breakage. So if you have a complex system, and you wish to make sure that some parts of it always survive, you need to decorrelate the risk that stuff breaks. Usually in the computer terms, there would be backups or whatever, or distributed systems, and similar things can be done to humanity in principle. Even if you just consider a Mars colony, we'd have a backup against most of the planetary disasters just presented, because a meteorite is striking only one planet at a time. A volcano will only explode on one planet. Even a pandemic might conceivably be stopped a lot better if there are long travel times between two planets. But once you start thinking big, you obviously also have to consider the more correlated risks, like supernova in vicinity. But they are not that bad, actually. I thought that the blast radius would be a lot larger. Well, this is not actually blast radius, but the radius where interesting effects still happen to ecosystems. Let's just specify that way. And obviously, this is a very fuzzy measure, but you need to put some limit on these. Anyway, the more common supernova type 2 is relevant up to approximately 30 light years, which means we need to travel some 70 light years or something to be actually safe. And supernova type 1a, which are a lot rarer but a lot brighter, have effects across approximately 1,000 light years. And while space is large, and in the largeness of space, really enormous stuff happens, the largest problems are gamma ray bursts, which are extremely bright sources of radiation. However, their brightness is not only caused by total energy levels, but also because of the geometry of the explosion. So most of the energy is ejected into a single beam, which means that while such events have effects on ecosystems across approximately 6,000 light years, it's like a beam extending from the explosions. If you would have your colonies in a triangle, for example, it's impossible to hit all three of them with a single beam. So we don't need to actually travel these 6,000 light years to get safety there. Yes, and then there is a totally different argument for why we should start colonizing space real soon now, because we're not just wasting the resources of our planet. If we assume sublight travel for all eternity, which many people do, we lose approximately one galaxy per year from the reach of the universe, because the universe is expanding, and at some point in time, we simply cannot reach a certain galaxy anymore, because the expansion of the universe is faster than light speed, and then you cannot ever possibly reach it again. So what does that mean? In a typical galaxy, according to Wikipedia, we'd have approximately 100 billion stars. Earth-like planets would be approximately in 1.6% of these systems, and if we assume that an Earth-like planet like Earth can sustain 1 billion humans for 50 generations, which I'd say is doable if you're a bit careful, then each second humanity loses raw resources for approximately 2.5 billion lives, which is quite a lot. Meaning that as we talk, multiple populations of this planet are essentially being wasted. Because we are giving up the chance to grab these resources and do stuff with it. Yes, so presume I convinced you that we would like to do this. Then the next question is, okay, what do we need to do there? How large does the colony need to be? We don't have, again, real experimental data on humans for minimum viable population size, but there is a problem. If you take too small a population, then inbreeding will very fast eliminate divergence in the genome, meaning that after a while you have totally genetically identical humans, which in itself is not necessarily a problem, but once you get a pathogen or some other evolutionary pressure on this group of people, there's a high risk of just all of them dying. This is usually what happens to animal populations once they get too small. But we have historical precedents. There was the Pitcairn Island, the Bounty Mutiny. Anyway, so 18 people moved to an island, essentially isolated from the rest of the world, and they had a stable population across approximately 200 years. Well, there can be a debate about how stable, in particular psychological stable, these people actually were, but they survived. yes, and scientists like numbers, so people have thought about, okay, can we maybe by simulation or theoretical observations predict minimal necessary population sizes? And medium term here means some 100 years. So with only 50 people, you could probably keep up a colony for some 100 years. If we talk long-term, as in a few thousand years, we would need 500 people. Actually, the effect of human population size, meaning the number of individuals with totally divergent genomes you would need to represent all currently existing human genes, is not that large. So it's only 11 to 12,000 people. You would need to very carefully select and put on a colony to actually have a copy of each gene variant currently here on Earth. Well, we don't know where exactly these genes are because we don't scan the DNA for everybody, but it's just theoretical, right? And for once, radiation exposure could actually be pretty useful, because the problem is not like bad genes, as it is sometimes naively assumed, that if you have inbreeding, then bad genes will get expressed. Well, they are getting expressed, but this put very high evolutionary pressure on these very specific alleles, leading to the fast extermination of them. The problem is actually that after a while you have totally uniform genomes there. And radiation exposure means higher mutation rates, means you actually get more diversity. Okay, what could we do with another colony except having a backup? So some people are not totally convinced just by saying, okay, we could save humanity from a lot of disasters, but they say, yeah, but what's in for me? For example, money, or what can we do with another planet? We could get raw materials for local consumption, which gets more interesting in the lower points with more population. We can possibly get raw materials in a shallower gravity well, meaning we can colonize space faster and do more interesting stuff without expending that much energy, because launching stuff from the ground of Earth is actually quite expensive. We can gather more solar energy, And in particular, we can support more population. And more population, in my opinion, could in particular lead to a trade of culture and science, because trading information or data is quite cheap compared to actually trading stuff. And you have large network effects. So just because if you have twice the population, you probably get more than twice the research rate and even cultural rate, whatever that is. So I'd fully expect that this will be more than just a linear increase. Also, history has shown very useful byproducts of all space research. And there can even be a political argument being made that a lot of the economy support actions by large political organizations could just as well be done by space research projects, because the main idea is putting money in the economy and getting people to work on stuff. For example, in Germany there are projects restoring historical buildings and historical parks. And I can totally tell you that the return of investment on a historical park is negligible. I mean, it's like the historical park afterwards looks like a historical park, pretty much like it was beforehand, say 100 years ago. In another 100 years, you'll have to do another restoring project, and then this continues ad infinitum. Not very useful, in my opinion. Whereas research adds up. You do research once, and you also get all the nice economic effects of trickle down, whether that exists or not, but the same, pretty much the same economic stuff would happen, but you get additional research output. Yes, and then we are talking about cost. So how costly is it actually to, say, create a Mars colony? Initially, one would assume that it's arbitrarily infinite amounts of money, but that's not the case. So NASA actually publicly announced an approximate budget plan for hypothetical Mars mission consisting of 7 to 10 people. And they said that it would be $7 to $70 billion, so it's say 50 billion euros. Of this, approximately half of it is just rocket boosters, booster rockets to get the stuff out of the gravity well. Just as a comparison, the defense budget, for example, of Germany is nearly that amount, 30 billion euros. So it's not like an arbitrary amount of money. This is stuff you can, as, for example, the European Union, actually pay for if you want to. Yes, but I did not only talk about Mars. So this Mars problem is essentially solved. Like, NASA has a plan how to do it if they just wanted to do it and had the money, which people could, in theory, give them. But there is also a problem of escaping the larger risks like supernova and gamma ray bursts, and we will obviously need interstellar travel. Things don't look that bright in that area. So there was a joint propulsion conference in Hartford, Connecticut in, I think, 2004, was it? Anyway, that time frame approximately. And there was a joint statement at the end saying it is highly improbable that humans will ever explore beyond the solar system. And other people from the same conference essentially said, okay, yeah, but a trip to Proxima Centauri, which is quite a near star system, which has maybe useful planets, would need 100 times more energy than the entire planet Earth currently generates. Yeah, and then there were some plans how to actually do that, and well, most of these plans had some kind of totally inconceivable device in it. For example, a 10 million gigawatt laser. So if only we could have a 10 million gigawatt laser, yeah, we could do interstellar travel. Problem is, we don't. And this continues for a lot of designs. So like, okay, we can do interstellar travel given 500 grams of antimatter. Yeah, but we don't. So conclusion, shit. This is, anyway, a conclusion some people have taken. The other conclusion, which is at the end of every research paper, is more science is clearly needed. So we can't do it yet, right? Let's just do some back over the envelope calculations. So say we want to accelerate one metric ton, say three humans plus some stuff. This is back over the envelope. If we take 10 times the amount, it doesn't really matter because it's still order of magnitude stuff we're talking about here. But say we want to accelerate one metric ton to 10% light speed, which would give us a travel time of 40 to 50 years to nearby star systems. So this is not like pleasant, but it's doable. If you find sufficiently insane people, you could just send them on this mission. You'll get an insane space colony, but yeah, better than nothing, right? And actually, there are some organizations I'll talk about later, like Mars One. They are
currently screening candidates for a one-way mission to Mars with a survivability probability of, I don't know, certainly not 100%, and they are like having tenth of a thousand of applicants. So this is totally not a problem to find sufficiently insane people. Yeah, I mean, seriously. Okay, leaving us with the problem of finding sufficient energy to do it. But actually, it's not that much. So this is a speed where relativistic effects shouldn't matter that much. So I just used classical mechanics and Wolfram Alpha to do the calculation, resulting in an energy need of approximately 4.5 times 10 to the power of 17 joule, which is something. In particular, 1/30th of the total energy production of the USA in 2001. So this is not actually inconceivably much. And 2001 is already more than 10 years ago, so the total energy production of the United States of America and the world as a whole has increased by another factor of, I don't know, 2 to 3 years, so at least. So this mass is, this energy is actually 5 kilogram mass equivalent, which was a little bit contrary to my intuition, which is why I am mentoring it here. And the other question is, can we accelerate it fast enough? Maybe we can only do this with accelerations which would kill everyone. But it turns out we only need, say, 1,000 Newton for 1 year to get this 1 ton accelerated. And this is not very much, so you also don't need big thrusters or big rocket engines, you just need a little bit of a push. So in theory, we could do that. Okay, so how about practice? What could we actually put on our spaceship device thing to make it move? Currently, we have solid fuel and liquid fuel and all this kind of rocketry having a specific impulse of 250 seconds. The second union totally gives me the headache. Sorry? Yeah, maybe a little bit. Depends on the exact technology. Again, maybe I didn't mention that. So I'm, by profession, a theoretical computer scientist. By practice, I'm just a random hacker guy. So I have totally no real clue about this. All I ever talk about in this talk is from Wikipedia and the internet. So I will rarely answer questions in the end, I hope, if there's time. But don't expect me to personally have done anything to further this course except talking to people or actually contributed any kind of research here. The specific impulse is this very weird time unit, which essentially means how long you can sustain this thrust, which would actually push up the rocket by the same force its weight is pulling it down, which kind of makes some sense if you're trying to stand on the floor, but this guy is shaking his head, so probably it's wrong. Yes, so if you just want to compare stuff, then it's okay, right? Yes, so we have solid fuels. Then there was this idea of a solar sail. So essentially you just put a big parachute in space which reflects photons or other kinds of radiation and hope that, well, the sun shines on it and pushes it away. And this sounds totally like science fiction until you realize that, I think it was Japan, actually already had a successful mission accomplished using this technology to monitor the sun using some kind of satellite. And it achieved a delta velocity of only 100 meters per second, which is really minuscule, in 6 months, but it was a prototype also for this propulsion device. So this was already tested in production use and successfully. Same thing with ion thrusters. So the problem with solid fuel rockets is that you propel a lot of mass away from the rocket quite fast. But quite fast is not incredibly fast. And the idea of an ion thruster is to propel stuff away from your rocket incredibly fast, but use less stuff. The advantage is that you need less stuff to carry around with, meaning that you need to accelerate less stuff in the beginning of the journey. This gives rise to this higher specific impulse, which is, as we have learned, a kind of rate of efficiency. Creating these high exhaust velocities needs a lot of power, but this can, at least at these power levels, still be done by solar sails or nuclear reactors, as in, oh, how are they called? Anyway, there are nuclear reactors which essentially work by using the heat differential between some self-sustaining slow nuclear reaction and rest of space. So it's not like a real nuclear power plant up there. And then there is this very complicated called variable specific impulse magnetoplasma rocket, which essentially is like an ion thruster, but using magnetic fields to accelerate stuff, but has the added advantage of being able to provide a lot more thrust at the cost of lower specific impulse if you actually need that for some kind of maneuver. And this totally, if you read the designs, it sounds a lot like science fiction until the people mentioned that NASA is going to employ such a 200 kilowatt device in 2015 to the ISS to stabilize the orbit. So it's not like this is science fiction, this is actually currently being deployed, essentially. Yeah, and then this is stuff we have used or are pretty much about using. And then there is propulsion research, so upcoming stuff we could possibly do. First point is just better ion thrusters, essentially. So by doing ion thrusters differently, namely using a little bit more acceleration stages and some engineering fiddling they are not yet finished with, you get a lot higher specific impulse, basically by accelerating stuff even faster. And this is in the phase of what I'd call initial engineering. So it was theoretically predicted, and it was built, and people looked at the actually realized exhaust velocities and weren't quite totally happy, and then they're trying to get a little bit more efficiency out of their prototype. But it is essentially there, it works. Then there is a very weird idea of the Q thruster. The problem I already talked about is that you need to expel stuff from your rocket. And all this stuff you want to expel, you need to take with you initially. But what if you could expel something else? So, for example, in a typical jet engine, you expel a lot of hot air. In space, you could conceivably expel oxygen, you have oxygen, hydrogen you have collected from space. But you can expel apparently something even stranger, namely virtual vacuum particles, which exist only in some kind of theoretical physical models. Interesting thing is, people have built a prototype and it seemed to work. So I don't really care why. So they're currently trying to build a larger prototype, providing 1 newton at a power consumption of 3 kilowatt, which would actually give us our 1 to 10% light speed at 30 megawatt power consumption. And well, this is hard to do in space because of the because of the heat generated from all this power generation, but it's not totally out of limits, right? Yeah, and then there is a lot of other more exotic stuff, like some guy has thought up a nice way to actually create photons and expel those from the rocket and gather all the reactive impulse into the rocket. Only problem is you need a lot of antimatter and you don't have that. Then there is, interestingly, the LQP air drive, which promises faster than light travel by doing some weird space-time hackery I'm totally not understanding. Again, the interesting thing is NASA claims they have a prototype and they're currently trying to measure whether it actually affects space-time by doing some interferometer experiments. And in my August talk, it said, okay, the initial experiments are being planned and they're currently running, and first results are slightly positive but not yet significant. So it looks like there might be something happening actually, which would be awesome, obviously. And there are some official statements from NASA which are publicly available from their website saying, actually, is there any way around special relativity? And maybe. So we don't totally know that yet. Also, let me warn you about that one, because there's a lot of journalist reporting of the latest results saying they managed to reduce the mass of the vehicle from the size of Jupiter to the size of 500 kilograms, comparable to some early space probes. This is actually right. They reduced the necessary mass to 500 kilograms. What the journals didn't get is that it's not about a vehicle mass, but mass equivalent energy. So you'd need approximately 250 kilograms of antimatter to do that. Yeah, we're not there yet, obviously. Yes, and I think this will be around the last topic I want to start. Who is actually doing all this stuff, and how much resources are we actually spending on this stuff? Presuming that this is important to get humanity across the next few thousand years, one would think that maybe we could actually spend some money on it. Yeah, we do, in a sense. So the NASA approximately gets $17.6 billion, and so on and so on. The Russian Federal Space Agency is the next one, then ESA, then the Japanese, Chinese, and Indian one. You can read all this in this source. It's just a list of numbers. There are also some private institutions coming up now, because some people apparently are not quite happy with the speed of the official government research. The first company totally gave me the laughs when I looked at their homepage, because it looks like a reflection of GeoCities. I totally recommend visiting this second link down there. You'll find a lovely webpage looking exactly like a 1990s GeoCities homepage. Like, there's an iframe, there's ugly animations and stuff like that, and it looks totally ridiculous until they tell you that they have two prototypes of inflatable habitat stuff already in orbit and are going to dock them to the ISS in 2015. So, yeah, apparently those skills are totally different. Then there is this Planetary Resources company. They're actually called Planetary Resources. They are well, having some kind of believable business plan trying to really mine asteroids. Currently they are selling share time slots on very cheap telescopes in low orbit to get their business started. And then there is the non-profit Mars One, which essentially is just trying to get one Mars colony going. And they are these people trying to screen the applicants currently. Also, they have assigned the contracts for the first unmanned mission, well, test missions essentially, to start in 2015 to 16. So there's also stuff moving, actually. Yes, bringing me to this, in my opinion, very, very sad slide. Because the question is, okay, we are giving some money to these institutions. We are doing something to ensure continued survival of humanity, but is it much? Let's try to answer it this way. The gross world product in money, which is not totally accurate, but we need some numbers to compare here, is approximately 84 times 10 to the power of 12. This would be trillions, if I'm not wrong, dollars. So this is the productivity we have, or what the economists see of the productivity anyway. So what do we do with it? 1.5 of these trillion dollars go to military expenses. Some of this might actually help space expansion, like high energy research, coil gun research for orbital launches, but a lot of it is just ammunition, tanks, boring stuff. I mean, you don't have a return of investment on this stuff. It just explodes and it's gone. And if you're unlucky, it's also something else explodes, and then your return of investment is quite negative. Then you have international tourism. Okay, I'm not against tourism. We are all here because we can travel all over the world. But there is a lot of money going in that. Though it's just ordered by big things I believe humanity could do a little less with without totally dying or becoming very unhappy. Then there is science. So I like science, obviously. So this is just for comparison. Then there is marketing. We spend $500 billion approximately on marketing. Those are worldwide marketing budgets of everybody combined. And guessed in a lot of things. And the number comes from Wikipedia, so it's not my guessing. But it must be around this somewhere. And in my opinion, this is ridiculous compared to the next bullet, namely what we actually pay for space stuff, which is approximately, I don't know, 7% of that. So we are spending significantly less on ensuring that we can spread to space and save humanity than we spend on trying to sell stuff to people. And marketing, unfortunately, is quite a zero-sum game. So if Coca-Cola and Pepsi start a marketing war, you either get one brown water plus caffeine or the other one, but it's not going to make a life of difference. And certainly it's not necessary to spend all this money on such stuff. So yeah, this kind of ends my presentation excerpt from the internet thing. If there are questions or some need of discussion, please start now.
So for questions, please line up at the microphones. And where's the signal angel? Okay. Are there questions from the internet?
Yes, there are two questions from the internet. One is, could we also use the swing-by effect for acceleration, just as the Voyager probes did?
Yes, so people have done that. You can do it, obviously. That would save a lot of fuel or stuff you need to take with you. It might lengthen some travel times, might not necessarily mean much for interstellar travel though, if I'm not totally wrong, because you actually need to accelerate for quite long times across interstellar medium where there isn't much to accelerate with using swing-bys. But I'm not a space engineer, so I might be fundamentally wrong about all the mechanics here.
Okay.
Just one short addition to that one, because swing-by, or at least using other orbits, might be a very, very, very interesting way for generation ships to leave the galaxy, because there are Rook stars traveling across the gravity wells of galaxies. And if you're thinking about real big time scales, this might be a very energy efficient way to move a lot of people around.
Okay, thank you. Another problem is how to slow down for arrival in another solar system. I think you cannot swing down around a planet from 0.1% of light speed.
Yeah, well, you essentially slow down the same way you accelerated. You turn around and then you fire the thrusters the other way. This means you accelerate and decelerate approximately the same length of time. There are some ideas about decelerating with solar sails in particular, just deploying a large solar sail and letting the radiation of the target star decelerate you, but thrusters would probably be a faster way to actually brake. But this means you need to take the propellant all the way with you, obviously.
Okay, thank you. So far, those are all questions from the internet.
Okay, so microphone 1, 2, and then the one in the back.
Hi, thank you for the first part of your presentation. I really love the way how you enumerated the problems that we have on this one only planet that we have. And I'm a proponent of your first option, the tree hugging. And so when you moved away from that, saying that that's a difficult thing to do and we should go for the second option, my question is, which right do we have to destroy this planet for the rest of the living creatures and then just leave?
Well, this is a very philosophical and possibly moral question, and indeed it's totally right to ask that one. But then again, there is a lot of planets out there where we would destroy no creatures whatsoever. So, say, the moon. If you totally dismantle the moon, there are not many species going to be very sad about it. Same thing probably goes for Mars, and unfortunately also probably goes for a lot of Earth analogs. And yes, you can make an argument that the galaxies or the universe's resources are to be shared fairly, in where fairly means to more intelligent species than us. And I'm not totally opposed to that, but I think that at least a few more planets would add a lot of safety for very low costs, even if we take all the other species we don't know about into account.
Okay, can we continue this later on?
Indeed.
Thank you. Hi, two quick remarks and a question. First remark, solar sails. If they get too big, they get kind of fragile and you have to, it's just not handleable anymore. I think that's not really a way to transport a big vehicle. Second remark to the supernovas, that shouldn't be a problem because they are mostly like the big stars that really produce supernovas when they die are concentrated in the center of the galaxy. So if you won't travel there, you know, it shouldn't be a big problem because you don't have O-class stars in the arms of the galaxy.
This sounds sensible, but if I remember correctly, there was one of these many pages I read, there was actually a concrete star named within the vicinity of our solar system, which might conceivably undergo supernova 2 type explosion within, the near future, as in a few million, 2 billion years. But anyway, this stuff exists.
Okay.
Not often, but it does.
Yeah, but the probability is pretty low, I think. And on the last slide, I was wondering what the rest of the money was. I mean, if you add up all the numbers, it's only like
A lot of
5 trillion.
I think a lot of it goes actually to consumption, as in food, clothing, construction. It's quite hard to get. Even these numbers were spread all over the internet. It's very hard to get any kind of numbers for gross global anything except military expenditure and total gross product, because everybody is criticizing this military thing, so there's a lot of numbers for that one. But apart from that, it gets very, very hot.
Okay, thank you.
Hello.
Sorry.
I'm going to make all the German a bit afraid, but...
It should be the microphone to the back first.
Hi. I have a question towards population growth. When you consider the current rate of population growing on the planet, do you think it's feasible that we reach the time of interstellar travel till we reach the capacity of human population on our planet? And let's say we do that, when would be the time that the population will double again on the next planet where we arrive?
So my personal, not very well-founded opinion on that is a very pessimistic one. So I expect that we will hit population growth limits one or the other hard way, actually. So there will be either food shortages or some other resource depleted, possibly leading to significant economic problems, which is also, in my opinion, a good reason to do this space expansion soonish, because we're currently having the possibilities to do all this stuff while we are not fighting for food, concrete, fertilizers, whatever. And then obviously you can't sustain exponential population growth on a non-exponential growing number of planets. So yeah, it's kind of obvious. So at some point you either get a hard limit or you need to limit our population growth some other way. Oh. And yeah, it doesn't look like it currently, unfortunately.
Yeah, cheers, thanks.
The red shirt.
Okay, so, okay.
Oh, you're going to die.
Yeah, so I'm sorry for all the Germans, but I didn't see any numbers on your papers about like nuclear like propulsion, because like, I'm sorry, there is like a lot of like stuff that could be used and technology that we already have that allow those kind of like travel and that, those kind of like...
Oh, you mean like Project Orion, for example?
I mean, that's one of the idea. There is like NERVA, there is like IEC, there is like antimatter triggered fusion. I mean, many.
So I certainly omitted a lot of physically possible propulsion systems. One I very specifically know about is this Orion idea, where you essentially have a huge lead shield and explode a lot of hydrogen or fusion or fission bombs below this shield in quick succession, which would actually be an awesome way to provide huge amounts of propulsion to a large spaceship. It only has some downsides, like other countries not liking a lot of nuclear explosions in the atmosphere, and possibly, if you do it wrong, nuclear fallout. But that's not necessarily that much of a problem if you actually know what you're doing. But many of these things were conceived and then discussed and then discarded, as we are not probably going to do that. And I might have wrongly excluded some of these options, which will in the end save humanity, and I just omitted them from the talk because I was too stupid. That might totally happen, actually. So please read more of this Wikipedia to find that.
And for your numbers, the world production of like antimatter is around 4 nanograms per year.
But we have global world production of antimatter. So think 5 years ago, 5 or 10 years ago, it was like, okay, we have created a positron, and everybody's like, yeah. And now we have like a worldwide production of antimatter in various particle accelerators. So in my opinion, this is a lot of progress, actually. But yes, it is in the range of nanograms, indeed.
Thank you. And now the one with the, I believe it's a Space Invader reflector.
Yes.
Oh, no.
First of all, I can add to the swing by question. It will help you get out of the solar system, and it will help you a lot. But for the total interstellar voyage, it will not make much of a difference. It's like if you wanted to walk from Sweden to South Africa, it's like the metro that helps you get out of Oslo. But then you still need to get to South Africa.
Okay. Thanks.
What I was going to ask you is, in your research, did you find a certain tendency of the thinking about this problem having changed over time? Was there a time when people were thinking about it more, or are we thinking about it now more than ever?
A little bit. So there was, during, I'd say, 30s to 60s, a lot more optimism in that regard, and then as there's always this hype curve, right? And then everybody got a little bit pessimistic and all the critics showed up. Problem is, I cannot actually answer that question for, say, the last 10 to 20 years, because my local filter bubble is very heavily constricted on some futurist forums, so I might totally have a wrong feeling for the dispersion of the opinion across the world population there.
All right, thanks.
I have a question. Wouldn't it be sensible to look at the problems of space travel with the same skepticism as on looking on solving the problems here on Earth? And what would that do of your presentation ideas?
So one reason why I believe that this space expansion thing might actually be more workable than solving the resource stuff on Earth is that there are some economic interests actually doing it. So it's very hard to convince everybody on Earth to reduce carbon dioxide production, for example. And you need to convince pretty much all large industrialized nations. But you only need to convince one or two large industrialized nations to do space explorations to win this. So it might be a lot easier on this political level. This is the main non-equality I'm feeling there.
On a similar note, don't you think that it's actually doesn't really solve the problem you proposed as opposed to the tree-hugging option? Because with the space exploration thing, okay, let's say we use all the military budget in the world to put a few people on Mars. Then we have a colony there. That might be our option in case something goes horribly wrong and the whole Earth is destroyed and humanity is wiped out. But until we get to the point that we can put a big fraction of the people on from planet Earth to Mars, that would be not the military budget, but like a few million times the military budget, so pretty unfeasible. So we still have to deal with all the environmental problems here on Earth, unless we just care about the survival of the species as a whole, and don't really care that a very big portion of it is going to die anyway.
Okay, so I'm starting to answer this in a very cynic way. So saving some maybe upcoming advances in anti-aging technology, we are all going to die really soon. So it is, in my opinion, mainly a matter. So there are two things you can optimize for. One is the happiness of current population or living population, let's say it. And then it makes total sense to go more towards this tree hugging, to have a very soft limiting approach to population growth, meaning that everybody who ever starts a life has a happy life and a long life and then ends it in some way. But then the question is, what about all these other lives we did not start because we didn't have the resources for them? So you can either, if you optimize for, say, average utility of people, then this option is good. But if you optimize for total utility, then it's totally insensible because you only get a few people compared to billions, well, trillions, actually.
Yeah. I just wanted to do a small remark regarding this travel speed, travel time thing, and ways around special relativity. I think if you go fast enough, then special relativity is actually going to help you with that. Because if you move fast enough, then although it might take 1,000 years at that speed, at that below light speed for the spaceship to travel to the other planet, the time which will pass for the astronauts in the spaceship will get smaller and smaller with the growing speed of the spaceship. And you can get them there in seconds for the astronauts, but it will still take 1,000 years for the other people outside the spaceship.
So you certainly cannot do it in seconds because you actually need to accelerate to that speed without just squishing everybody against the bottom of the spaceship. But yes, you can do it within reasonable time frames like 30 to 40 years, even for distances vastly larger than a few hundred light years. That's indeed correct. One problem is that you need to have all this energy for actually accelerating that fast, but it might be solvable. And the other one is shielding from radiation, so you're going to crash into random stuff. And even very small random stuff like hydrogen atoms in intergalactical space are quite energetic if you're traveling at near light speed, generating a lot of ionization in your spaceship, meaning in your humans, and we don't take it that well. But yeah, it is still, I mean, there are ideas for magnetic shields or electrostatic fields, but shields. So it's not inconceivable to actually do that once we get a good energy source, which is, I believe, the main problem here.
What you haven't gone to were space elevators, and main problem you always said is like getting mass and getting things into an orbit. And the only thing, I don't really know a lot about them, but the only thing I always hear about them is actually we got all the technology we would need to build them, we just aren't building them.
Yes, this is essentially the same problem we are also having with this Mars colony. We kind of do know how to approach that. We have been spinning carbon nanotube fibers in somewhere in the UK for a few years, and it looks like they would be strong enough to actually build a space elevator that way. So it's not like the technology is not there. It's mainly there is no political will to spend the resources. And so this would be one way to solve the orbit, to solve the problem of the gravity well. Yes, we would still need to propel our spaceships to Mars or some other stellar systems. There are also other launch options like huge koigons. So there are actually some designs accelerating a spaceship totally on the ground and then launching it directly into space from there. So apparently that can be done if you're willing to spend a lot of power and a lot of length to do it. But it's not impossible either.
Thanks.
Another question. Since we made such a mess already here, and as you suggested, if we send some insane people to colonize the next planet and we get this kind of insane colony there, what's the point if they are going to repeat all of our mistakes?
Okay, the question is a totally, my opinion, the question is what do we want to achieve personally or as a species, but in particular personally. So it is, this is also what I try to tell to some guy at the microphone too. It is a question, what are you trying to achieve in the end as in a few billion years? So will humanity have shaped the universe in a meaningful way, or will we have managed to kind of continue living on this planet? So this is okay. I mean, this is a valid option, totally a valid option, because it means that we might be able to guarantee a very happy and resourceful life for every human ever come into existence from now onwards. But it means we are going to have only a few billion to maybe 1 trillion humans across the lifetime of the universe, meaning we can create a lot less cool stuff, a lot less cool culture, a lot less cool science, a lot less cool anything. This is essentially my reason for just creating more population. And surely, life on a Mars colony, or even far more far away, will not be a very happy life. You need to survive. You need to actually like build habitation from rocks and not like call a big construction company. There is no construction company on Mars. It will be a very unhappy life. And we will reduce the average happiness of humans this path.
Okay, we have time for 2 short questions, and these are the very last ones.
Well, Australia started as a colony of criminals, so...
Yeah.
And we're doing fine, thank you very much.
Well,
although there might be some people in Australia heavily objecting to that statement,
yes.
As a side note. So I wrote my diploma thesis in Australia, so I had at least some background there. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to answer the question before why we should send people to Mars if we probably would mess up our civilization on Mars as well. Well, if you are that pessimistic, you can, in my opinion, just go in and shoot yourself because nothing will matter. What we should really keep in mind here is that a colony on Mars will be very much different, as you pointed out. Life on Mars will be very much different from life on Earth. So there will be a completely new form of civilization and a completely different form of culture there, which means there is an actual chance to make things better and to get things different, and I think the chances of achieving that in such a different and an alien environment as an other planet will be much higher than just trying to start over on Earth.
Thank you. I think that's a very nice conclusion for this talk.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. And also thank you all for your attention.